we talk in Indian country a lot about how, like, we're trying to help reframe folks to say, hey, we're not just in these museums, we're not just an artifact, but we're actually living, thriving communities.
Welcome to Power of Place, Stories of the Pacific Northwest. I'm Edward Krigsman. Last time we enjoyed a conversation with documentary playwright Nikki Oboa, and she guided us through the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest, or CHOP, circa 2020. And although this place existed for only a month, it raised enduring issues of racial and economic justice, police accountability, and solutions to ending homelessness that the media amplified onto a global stage. If I had to name any individual in Seattle capable of addressing many of the concerns raised by those protesters, it would be today's guest. Across varied leadership roles, she has ignited successful coalitions to bring about positive shifts in local housing, homelessness, racial justice, sustainability, and public safety. A former mayoral candidate and respected civic leader with more than 20 years championing Seattle's Native population, her experiences as an Indigenous woman, small business owner, and community organizer have informed her bold leadership. While executive director of Chief Seattle Club, she led the effort to create nearly $100 million in new affordable housing. In her current role as CEO of Native lifestyle brand 8th Generation, she's bringing this respected local brand to a global audience. She's been recognized as one of Seattle's most influential people by Seattle Magazine and Seattle Met. And so today we'll explore historic connections, both pre- and post-settlement, between Native people and to the place we now call Seattle. And we'll compare the appropriation of both Native places and Native cultural assets like art, including their modern-day economic impacts, such as disproportionately high rates of homelessness among Native people in Seattle. And we'll also look at the expanding role of Native leadership, from entrepreneurship and philanthropy, as well as in arts and culture, focusing on leadership by individuals, as well as by tribal governments, and their increasingly outsized impact on the region's economy. And as a case study, we'll focus on how the 8th Generation brand has fashioned a distinct new business model, addressing our historical cultural appropriations while empowering its artists. And stick around at the end of today's episode. You'll learn how you can get a 10% discount from 8th Generation.
Let's drive around.
So let's welcome our guest today, Colleen Echohawk. Hey, Colleen.
Hi. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So our podcast series is called Power of Place, and for all of us, place and name and people are intertwined. But I wanted to ask if you could introduce yourself while sharing a bit about those interconnections.
Thank you. So I'm Colleen Echohawk. I'm an enrolled member of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma. I also belong to the Upper Otna Athabascan people of Metasta Lake. I feel very connected to both of those places. I'm incredibly proud to be a tribal member of the great Pawnee Nation of the Kaitaki Band. We're originally from Nebraska and Kansas. We had our own Trail of Tears to Oklahoma, and now our reservation is there in Oklahoma. Have many wonderful beloved family members who live out there, and have this kind of dissonance in many ways, because all of our tribal affairs are happening in Oklahoma. But the reality is that we are from Nebraska and Kansas. You can go back and see photos and see some of the indentation in Nebraska and Kansas of where our agricultural gardens were. And I like to remember that and think about, like many Native people, we've been displaced from our traditional homelands, but there still is a connection back to those traditional places of where our communities, took care of each other through the land. So very much connected to those places. And then also, I was born and raised in Athabascan country out in Alaska. Feel incredibly fortunate that even though I don't have any Athabascan blood in me, the Athabascan community took my family in and just have been my family since I was born. They come through Seattle all the time and say, we're going to spend the night, Colleen, and take us to Muckleshoot Casino or one of the casinos, Snoqualmie, Tulalip, whatever it might be. And just feel very connected and very fortunate. I've grown up in Alaska. Like, Alaska is such a crazy place. Like, it's wild and independent, and it does, you know, people in Alaska do what they want to do. And I think I learned a lot having had that experience of growing up in Alaska. And then I've been in Seattle for 28 years. So I have been shaped by Seattle. I love this place. My husband's from Hawaii. We thought about living in Hawaii. We did. We lived in Hawaii for about a year, but I wanted to come back to Seattle. This is my home.
Can you share a little bit about any family member in Alaska that influenced you the most?
You know, there's a couple of things that come up to mind right away. Number one, my parents, who, you know, just, they found each other. My dad was from Oklahoma. My mom was born and raised in Alaska and really, like, created this beautiful childhood for me and my family. And then I have two grandparents, my grandma, Chatty Kelly, who taught me about being an entrepreneur and about being a business person. We always joke around that she was the first president of the Delta Junction Businessmen's Association, who was female. It was still called the Delta Businessmen's Association, but she ran a small business and hustled and taught me and my siblings how to, you know, think in that kind of world. And then I was incredibly fortunate to call Katie John, my grandma. I grew up with her. She is just an incredible figure who fought for subsistence rights for Native people in Alaska. And I was there when she was, my dad was the one who was like, Katie, like, this is not right. Like, there's got to be a way to find the way to get those traditional fishing and hunting rights back. And they did. And it was this huge case that has set the precedent for Native people around the country and also even around the globe. So I got to grow up with her, and I love telling the story, like, when I would come back when I was older with my own kids, and we'd, you know, fly to Fairbanks, and we'd take this incredible drive to the village, this beautiful, beautiful drive that took like 4 hours, and we'd get there, and we'd go immediately to her little log cabin that she had, and we'd open the door, and you'd just smell all the things that reminded me of her, like wood smoke, and she always had a pot of soup going, and like the smell of dry fish and all these things that just, you know, smell so like her. And before she would give me a hug, she wanted to hold my babies. And I would pass the baby to her, and she would hold the baby, and she would rock that baby back and forth, True and Zoe, and she would say, I'm your grandma, I'm your grandma, I'm your grandma. And she wouldn't say it like, you know, one or two times. She would say it like 20 times. And we all had to stop and just kind of watch her say that. And I look back on that, and I feel so lucky that my kids, in some ways, were just really imprinted. She was making the point to say, you belong to me. I am your grandma. And even though you live so far away in Seattle, you belong here in this space. And that is just, it was just so meaningful to me. And I feel so fortunate to have grown up with her and to have, you know, still be very connected to her legacy and the family. Yeah, she is amazing.
So what brought you then from Alaska to Seattle?
My auntie had worked at Pike Place Market Senior Center. And when I was 16, my parents had this idea that we should drive from Delta Junction, Alaska to Oklahoma. Now, it's a legend in my family. We call it the Hell Trip. Because it was a lot. It was like, I was 16, and then there was like 6 other kids who were younger than me, including a toddler. And so we had this pretty like rough trip. But when we got here to Seattle, we went to visit my dad's sister. She worked at Pike Place Market, and it was one of those like incredible July days, like here in Seattle, you know, those kinds of days we all live for in middle of January. So it was just beautiful and gorgeous. And there was like buskers on the street, and Pike Place Market was bustling. And I just remember telling my mom, I was like, I'm going to move here. I'm going to move here. And so that was always in the back of my mind. I met my husband in Hawaii, but then he was going to come here to UW. And I thought, this is great. Absolutely. And I came out here. I went to Shoreline Community College for a long time. And, man, it's very, very, feel very fortunate to have landed into this spot. I love this city. I love the local tribes. I work for a local tribe. 8th Generation is owned by the Snoqualmie tribe. And these tribes are just, they're pretty special. And they are really good to all of us who are Native that aren't from the tribes here. So I just feel like I found my place.
I know it's you.
Can you share a little bit about the history of the relationship between tribes and settlers as it relates specifically to place and land? Because that's going to foreshadow our conversation about homelessness and culture.
This is something I want to answer carefully because I am not from a Coast Salish tribe and do not ever want to be in a place where I speak for them or speak about them because it's just not my spot. But I can speak of what it means to be an urban native in Seattle. And that's a big reality for a lot of Native people. We need to always remember that there's over 80,000 Native people who live in King County. Some of those folks are Muckleshoot because they're in that King County space. But the reality is that there's also been a huge amount of Native people that were moved in from around the country in the 1950s and all the way to the 1970s because of the Urban Indian Relocation Act. And that was part of the federal government's move to bring Native people in the cities. Basically, they realized, wow, reservations are not working. And that's not, people are having a hard time out there. And so, many Native people came flowing into the city, and I ended up meeting, generations of families, Native families, who have been homeless since that Urban Relocation Act. And that's why we know that around the country, we have, thousands of Native people experiencing homelessness at much higher rates than anyone else. That, again, is because of that urban relocation.
Can you educate us? What was the federal government's motivation with the Urban Indian Relocation Act?
Well, I think the number one thing we have to remember is that, the federal government just thought of Native people as a nuisance. Like, it was just a problem. What are we going to do? The other thing I always remind people about, especially when it comes to design, is that, the way that Native people were talked about from like 1920s and the 1970s was literally we were called the vanishing race. They didn't expect us to be here. They expected that, all of the tragic things that had happened, the disease, starvation, the boarding schools, the forced sterilization of Native women, all of those things were contributing to what was sort of a goal, which was that we would be gone, we'd vanish. And so in the late 1950s, I think the Relocation Act was 1954 was the legislation was passed, and it continued on until the 70s. It was just an attempt to say, wow, well, they're still here, and we got to do something, and we got to figure out a way to, mobilize them. And also, it was also pretty clear in some of the early writing about the Urban Land Relocation Act is that the Native people would come in and would be the blue-collar workers. So, there was like, we train people to be maids, we train people to be the garbage collectors and to be those folks that kind of took care of urban centers. There was no like, oh, they'll be the next, mayor or CEO of a Fortune 500 company. And I think that is important to connect to because folks just don't still have a hard time seeing Native people in those kind of leadership spaces. So we're still battling through some of those things. And the Urban Relocation Act has had just a huge, huge impact on cities around the country.
Well, it's interesting, Colleen, because prior to that, the 50s, there was also the forced exclusion, right? The legislation where Native people were excluded from, from Seattle,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm so glad you brought that up because this is something that I just used to talk about all the time. But the reality is that, Native people in this city were like removed from, they were not legally allowed. There was actual legislation in the late 1800s that said you were not allowed within the city limits of Seattle. Again, they were a nuisance to the white settlers coming in, and it was just a way to, push them out, and hopefully they would just kind of disappear. And, there's just so much to say about the resiliency of our ancestors. I come from, 600 who survived that, our own genocide of the Pawnee Nation, and I think about them all the time, man, like, I'm so lucky to be here. I'm like glad. I'm so cool and grateful that they persisted and that they, just kept fighting and fighting so that I would be here and that my kids would be here.
Well, this would be a good place to talk about Indigenous aesthetics. Even though Native folks were excluded from the city limits, their art was celebrated and coveted.
Yeah. I'm remembering, before the new Burke Museum got built, I had the opportunity to go back and look at a collection of baskets. And there's incredible baskets that they have from, the 1800s on, and or even I think some are older. And I remember looking at them and just being kind of like, wow, this is incredible and beautiful and amazing. And then they actually happened to have like a birch basket that was made by some by Athabascans. And I started, I looked at it and was really just, moved to tears. There was just something I felt so connected with. And the moment, it was just so overwhelming. But I realized later that, there were so many, people that use those baskets in such a specific and beautiful way. And we know that happened out here, too, in Coast Salish territories. And those baskets were, not only were they beautiful, but they were also used. They were used for everyday work and everyday living. And so much of that was just so lost. And there was so much, again, there was this thought of like, well, these folks may not be around anymore. Let's hoard the art and design. Let's find a way to, take it in. I know of people who are very, very proud of, my great-great-grandparent, they bought this art, or they took the, they saw the opportunity. And the reality is that the folks who were selling it were either selling it because people had passed away, or they needed it desperately for just food and like basic living. And so we have to reckon with that real reality of that very old, old art and design that's around. And, I actively encourage people to return it back to the tribe if they know what it is. Some people will say, well, it's worth, a lot of money now. But what are you doing with it? It's just like sitting in a storage or sitting behind glass or something. Like, there's just a lot of that returning back to the tribal communities that could be pretty powerful. And there's also just reality, too, of some of it is just family. It belongs to families.
So it's great that you brought up the Burke Museum, because there's been, I think, a real shift there with a lot of input from tribal governments. And also, I think, there's been a huge shift at the Burke.
Huge shift at the Burke. Yeah. And it's beautiful and wonderful. And I think, one thing I love about Seattle, and I always try to remind people, is that in Seattle, because we are a progressive city, because we're an innovative city, and because we're a wealthy city, we should be leading the way in some of this work of racial justice and social justice. We should be showing people how to do it around the country. And I think the Burke is absolutely showing other museums around the country and around the globe how to consider and be thoughtful about Native artifacts and Native people in the museum. And I think that we talk in Indian country a lot about how like we're trying to help reframe folks to say, hey, we're not just in these museums, we're not just an artifact, but we're actually living, thriving communities that should be part of, leading the country forward. And, the reality for my kids, and I know a lot of other Native kids, is that And this really happened to my kids in, I think, second grade, when they were like learning about Washington State history, and they started learning about Native people in this area, and they would self-identify as being Native, and other kids would say, what? I thought Natives were dead like the dinosaurs. And so there's that still that ongoing legacy of the vanishing race idea that continues to perpetuate in today's society. And that's why it's so important for us to have leaders like Deb Holland and Sharice Davids out in Washington, and, Deborah Juarez here in Seattle, and, these incredible tribal leaders, Chairman De Los Angeles at Snoqualmie, and Chairman Elkins at Muckleshoot, and Chairman Forsman at Suquamish. Like, why is that not a normal part of a Seattleite's participation in the civil dialogue? They should be as well known as Mayor Harrell, And so, that is just part of the continuing growing as a community we should be leading in Seattle.
Colleen, for those of our listeners that aren't familiar with Chief Seattle Club, can you share what is the organization?
The Chief Seattle Club is a Native-run organization that is a response to the very, very high rates of Native people experiencing homelessness. And so if you live in Seattle and you're a Native, you have a much higher rate of experiencing homelessness or the likelihood of experiencing homelessness more than any other population in Seattle. And so the Chief Seattle Club is a response to that. It was originally a day center. Now we are a big, affordable housing developer and, all kinds of amazing programs. But originally it was just very, very basic drop-in center. And let me tell you, the Native homeless community loves it. One thing I love to share about the homeless community is that, they might have been outside experiencing like the worst things. And believe me, when you are homeless, you do experience the worst things. It's very, very hard to be homeless. But Archie Seattle Club members, like, they would walk in the doors and, they'd, go to the bathroom and, maybe shower, but get food. And then all of a sudden our community space would be full of laughter and joy. And I think that's one of the gifts that Native people have in our background is just like, this has sucked, but we're going to have fun anyways. We're going to have a good time. We're going to enjoy each other. We're going to talk. We're going to joke around. We're going to be sarcastic. And I saw that lived out in such an incredible, incredible way at the Chief Seattle Club. It was truly I just feel like I just got so lucky to get to serve the Native community in that way.
So tell us about how you became the executive director of Chief Seattle Club.
Well, I was on the board at Chief Seattle Club, and I was working at UW in public health and was sort of thinking about getting a PhD, but was also not loving all the writing. It was just not vibing very much. I was getting to go out and work at the tribal communities and do a lot of cancer prevention education. So that was good, but it was just wasn't quite feeling it. And I was on the board at Chief Seattle Club. We were looking for an executive director. I was on the hiring committee. We couldn't find anyone. And long story short, someone was like, Colleen, you should think about it. And then 3 days later, I was hired. And I feel like I was just so fortunate. I feel like the ancestors were really guiding and leading me in that moment, as I hadn't thought so much about it. I hadn't thought about executive leadership and as part of my role in life. And just getting to get into the work at Chief Seattle Club was so interesting. I think my first 3 months, I just soaked up the community, and being a board member, we interacted sometimes with we call them club members, and they're really, folks who are experiencing homelessness and who are Native. But getting to spend that day-to-day interaction with folks was just so illuminating. And one story I love to share is that, and part of the reason that I just dove head first into the work was I was sitting at my desk one day, and I grew up with a lot of Native people in and out of my home because we just did. One of them was this guy named Ambrose, and my dad had picked him up hitchhiking. He was from a village way up north in Alaska, and he ended up living with us in our house for over 3 years. My dad was notorious for picking up hitchhikers, still is. I don't see many hitchhikers, but if there's one out there, my dad will find it. And so Ambrose stayed in our home. He had a lot of struggles, was a boarding school survivor, was a vet, and just had a lot of hard things that were happening in his life. But he loved music. He taught me how to play the piano. We played the piano all the time together. And it was just a very charming, amazing person. And he eventually moved out of our home, and we kind of lost track of him. But then we heard one day that he was in Seattle. And actually, my aunt, who I mentioned earlier, she's like, oh, yeah, I've seen Ambrose out there. And then we heard, little blips about him. And then we heard that he had passed away, and he had passed away homeless on the streets in Seattle. And so, always we just loved Ambrose. It was just so hard to hear that about how he had died. But so one day I was sitting at my desk at Chief Seattle Club, and I thought, if he had been in Seattle and was Native, he probably would have come through Chief Seattle Club. So I type his name into our system. And sure enough, he was a member at Chief Seattle Club. And not only had he been a member, he had been a member 3 days before. He had been at the Chief Seattle Club and had lunch and gotten to programming or whatever. And so I was just stunned. And I call my family. I'm like, Ambrose is not dead. He's alive. He's a client here at Chief Seattle Club. So when he was in the at the agency one day, I went up to him at a lunch and I said, hi, Ambrose. I said, do you recognize me? And it was such a dumb question because I was like 10 or 11 years old last time he had seen me. And then I said, well, I'm Howard and Yvonne's oldest daughter, Colleen. And he literally like grabbed his chest and like just his whole chair went back because he was just so shocked that it was me. And we ended up having this beautiful conversation and are still in contact. And, you know, I always tell people like the Chief Seattle Club members and people who are Native who are experiencing homelessness, they are my relatives. Like literally I grew up with them in my household. And there's something about it that just honestly fueled me with anger. I thought this is insanity that Native people on Native tribal lands that we are the most likely to be homeless. And so I was fueled by love for my community and anger at the government and at everyone who has been in charge for a long time that we were in this situation, and just became very, very focused on changing the outcomes for our relatives.
You mentioned your motivation that, you know, a mixture of love and anger, really. And then what did that cause you to take on next?
Well, yeah, like I look back on this, like it's been, I started at Chief Seattle Club in like early 2014. And I look back and I'm just so like, wow, a lot happened. I think I spent that first 3 months of going, whoa, this is amazing. These are beautiful and wonderful people. I always try to remind people like, when we have so many people experiencing homelessness, like, what are we missing in society? You know, because these are folks who have a hard time, like, kind of really participating in civil dialogue or in thought because it's so hard to, like, to maintain, like, anything when you're homeless, right? Like, you're always looking for food. You're in shelter. And so I think, like, part of what is such a tragedy about, like, the craziness of homelessness in our country when we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are experiencing homelessness is that we're missing out on innovation and on new design ideas and, you know, ways for us to do things better. And it's a real tragedy in my mind. And so when I saw what's going on at Chief Seattle Club and saw the high and began to understand the numbers, and I can remember one time I was getting deep into the policy, trying to understand the policy. I had no idea. I was not a policy nerd like I am now, but at the time I was just going to meetings and trying to understand. And I saw some data from King County, and it said that, hey, listen, there was a priority list of people that were really needed housing. And there was in one time frame, I don't know if it was a year, but there had been 19 people, 19 Native people who had gotten the call to get into housing. That it was a call that said, hey, we've got your place. We're ready to go. Like, this is you. These are probably people that needed permanent supportive housing. And out of that 19, only one person got into it. And I started to think, like, what happened? Like, and we started investigating, seeing what happened. And what we realized is that the mainstream housing providers just did not provide places for our Native community to feel like they fit in, to feel like they were loved, to feel like that they were important. And we have to remember, because of all of the tragedy and loss that's happened in the Native community, the loss of our traditional housing, the loss of our traditional urban planning, the loss of all of that, the loss of culture and design, like Native people often feel kind of like alone. And so that was what's happening, is that our folks who were getting the call, they might go down there and just felt like, nope, this is not for me. But they felt connected to Seattle Club. So we started thinking, okay, we got to build housing. And I always like to say, I'm very grateful for my friend Daniel Malone from the Downtown Emergency Service Center. And I remember sitting there talking to him, and he was like clear too. He's like, yeah, it's not working for Native people. And I was like, well, we should probably build housing. And I said, it sounds so hard. And he goes like, Colleen, it's not rocket science. It's not rocket science. You can do it. And I would say that to myself every day, pretty much, because we did dive into housing. And I will say that we were not warmly received at first. I can remember, like, I identified that there was a site right next to the Chief Seattle Club that we could probably get for a very good deal because it was owned by Catholic Community Services, and we had a good relationship with them, and we thought that they might kind of just help us get that building or get that spot. And it was really run down affordable housing at the time. That's what was in there. And I remember going to the Office of Housing, and they were like, Colleen, you guys have no equity, you have no other property, you have nothing, you have no experience. And honestly, they just kind of laughed. They laughed in my face. It was like, no, you guys are not going to do this. And so, honestly, that also made me really angry and fueled the flames. And I had the back noise in my head of Daniel saying, it's not rocket science. You can do this. And so we just got really determined. We started going to all of our elected officials. I love to remind people that there's such incredible allies in this community. One of them was Councilmember Sally Bagshaw, and she just got incredibly behind the project and said, we have to figure this out. We have to do it. And she's like, we got to do something different. Keeping going in the same way we've been doing it forever is insanity. Like, let's do something different. So because of the power and courage of some elected officials, we were able to get the site and start building housing right next door to the Chief Seattle Club. It's all finished now. It's called the All Building. It is the first building in the downtown core that has a Lushootse name. You know, if we lived in a just society, we'd all be speaking Lushootse right now. That is the traditional language of the communities that we're surrounded by right now. And so we are really proud to have that Lushootse name, which translates just to home. Then one thing that I will continue to say, probably till the day I die, is that we in urban cities specifically, but just throughout the whole country, we base our design aesthetic on a very colonial perspective. That is because the majority of urban planners and architects are white. And so until we can correct that, I think that the data is that only 3% of architects are Black. And the Native folks, we are, you know, I'm saying in quotes, statistically insignificant, which is a terrible thing to say about anyone, but we don't even make the charts, right? So,
and especially for a group that's so instrumental to this country.
Absolutely, right? Like, we should have longhouse-style housing and coastal design everywhere in the city. But until we do that, we have to find ways to ensure that we're bringing those Native voices into that space. And so with the All Building, we had so much fun, like, having design sessions with, you know, our folks who had been experiencing homelessness and who were Native. And so that building, you know, we're incredibly proud of it. On the side of the building is a representation of what we call her the matriarch. It's a very large representation of a Native woman wearing a traditional cedar cape from this area. And she's when the urban relocation happened, it was the Native women who came together and they supported each other. They supported, you know, children and community. And so the matriarch on that side of the building is kind of in honor of those women who really ensured that we all could be here today.
Well, Colleen, homelessness continues to be one of the most complex problems to solve. What can we take from your experiences building housing for this population?
I think the reality is that more people of color are experiencing homelessness. And so we need to see solutions coming from the Native community, coming from the Black community. What we did at Chief Seattle Club has been incredibly effective, like so effective. We're bringing people into housing who haven't been in housing in 20 and 30 years. Like, it's so effective because it comes from a culturally attuned space, right? Where we saw the Native community saw the need of our own community and we're able to bring forward the solutions. And I think that is something we have to look at in, you know, our LGBTQ community who experience high rates of homelessness, especially the youth. We see that in the Black community. And so it's very important that we find ways to hear those voices and to ensure that they have leadership, that we're following their leadership. Now, that's difficult because if you're from a community that hasn't had any power or any money or any kind of way to build housing, we're going to make mistakes, you know? Like, I tell you, I made some big mistakes when we built housing at Chief Seattle Club, you know? And so, yeah, I think that when we think about the big solutions that we need to find for our homeless community, we have to realize like that things are gonna things are going to fall apart at some points. And we see it happening right now. The King County Regional Homeless Authority, everyone is like, you know, really upset. Like we're, you know, it's not working. And to me, it seems very obvious that this would not work right now. And that because what we've tried to do is to say this community that has been hurting and suffering for so long, we have the Black community, the Native community, the federal government has done us wrong for so long. So this small amount of money that's going in the reality that's going towards this authority, there's going to be big failures. There's going to be things, and I think we have to give room and space for that. And I know it can be very hard because those are taxpayer dollars. But I think in order to get to the success that we want to get, then we have to give room for some big mistakes. As we shift power and as we shift resources, there's going to be, you know, shaking, and we've seen that happen.
So, Colleen, we've heard the idea that some experiencing homelessness actually want to be homeless. What's your take on this?
I never met one person who wanted to be in that situation. You know, they had experienced, you know, maybe generations of homelessness, that's all they knew. Or maybe they had fallen into hard times because they had a parent that got sick and they had to quit their job to take care of the parent. Or, you know, there's just like all these things that lead to, or maybe they were a foster kid. You know, I think it's like, it's this huge number of Native kids who come out of foster care who like fall into homelessness. People who come out of, you know, rehabilitation institutions. Like, there's just so many factors that we know lead to homelessness, and that's why the prevention programs are so important. And so I have just never met someone who said, I want to be in this situation. I have met people who said, I can't find the solution that actually meets the real need I have. And that's the problem, right? You know, like there's folks who are, I've met people who are couples and they said, I don't want to go to an all-woman shelter. I want to be with my husband. I want to be with my child or someone who has a dog, you know? So the system is changing to try to make, you know, accommodations for those kinds of folks. But the reality is that we have to find solutions that meet that person's need, and we haven't been able to effectively do that.
So you mentioned earlier that Seattle is a very wealthy city, right? We produce an enormous part of the country's GDP. Yeah. We've got these great companies, and we have these problems like homelessness. So why is there this dissonance between the difficulties of really functioning and the wealth that we have?
Yeah. Let's see, a year ago or so, I got the opportunity to speak at a conference called Native Women Lead, and it was all about Native business owners. And so there was like 100 women in this room, and it was such a privilege to talk to them. They're all business owners, incredible people. And on the stage, and this kind of flew out of my mouth, as things tend to do, I said, imagine if one of us in this room was Jeff Bezos. And the whole room just started to die laughing, because the reality in our communities, especially as women, and you know, we would never hoard wealth. Like I come in from, you know, in Alaska, and then we're also, I come from potlatch culture, and we're also in potlatch culture right here in Washington State with the Coast Salish tribes. Like there's this idea of bringing in all of this wealth and all of this and saving it up and then giving it all. Some people give it all away. And there's this culture, like I mentioned to my dad, you know, he could not resist someone who was homeless in Alaska. He would literally move them into our home. And so when I was speaking to these Native women, we were all like kind of saying that, you know, as we were laughing about that idea, there is just a dynamic of power and of influence that we haven't had yet in the Native community in the business world, if that makes sense. Like there, as far as I know, there are no Fortune 500 leaders who are Native. There are very few who are women, as we know. There's very few who are people of color. And I think that has a big impact on society. I think that has a big impact on the way that we see money, that we understand prosperity. And I believe, you know, I am not an anti-capitalist by any means, but I am that kind of person that says, you know, when one person has so much wealth or one company doesn't, what is that societal impact on people? And it's not like I'm trying to, I'm not mad at Jeff Bezos, But I would love to talk to him and say, hey, let's think about things that could happen. You know, how much wealth does one person need? And, you know, when you study colonialism in an academic setting, that's one of the things that people talk about is that, you know, that capitalism is a incredible part of that colonial mindset of, you know, make as much money as you possibly can. And so there is just a way of, I think that we can do better in the world. Like I say that all the time about Seattle. Like I think that these are, that there are incredible people here. I think that they want to do the right thing, that there's this desire to focus on justice. And I think we do understand the data, but we fall flat when it comes to the courage to actually make some of these kind of decisions of trusting people, trusting communities of color. And I shouldn't say we fall flat. I think that we're slow. We're slower than we think. And so I think that there is movement forward and that there is that desire, but I think there is a lack of, still is that lack of trust around, you know, communities of color. And I can tell you that, like, one of the harder things for me being in the business world now and also running around for office is that there's this sort of ongoing theme of, you probably might remember the Sesame Street song that says, one of these things is not like the other.
I do remember.
You know? And I always feel like that in those spaces. Like, when I was in the nonprofit world, there was more Native people that were in those spaces. But, you know, running for office, being in the business community, thank God I'm a major extrovert and I like, yeah. and I'm also an aggressive optimist and I like everyone. So it's like, I can be in those spaces pretty comfortably now, but it also, sometimes I look around the room and go, wow, I'm the only one here.
Well, you decided to run for mayor.
I did.
That was sort of a next phase after leading Chief Seattle Club. Why did you do that?
You know, I never had political ambitions. Like I really did not see myself there. But one, I was getting asked a lot. And the reason I was getting asked to run for mayor was because I happened to have the expertise at the time that that the city needed. I, you know, have built housing. I had created really effective programs for the homeless community. I'd been working in police accountability. That election was, you know, only a year or so after the horrific murder of George Floyd. And I had served on the community police commission for many years. I led the last chief of police search for Carmen Best. And so there was just also just knowledge that, you know, I think I could have been a, and it maybe will in the future, a good executive leader. I like that. I've realized that that in this point in my career, that's what I'm good at. And so, you know, I thought, why not? I want my kids to take risk and to see the possibilities for Native people in the future. And I thought, you know what, if I'm getting asked to do this, if I feel like I do have the right kind of skills that the city needs and I do, and I love this city, then why not? And so I did. I'm so glad I did. And it was a really great experience.
What did you most learn from that experience?
The thing I learned most was that I just have to stick to my message. I think that part of what could have made me a good politician is also one of my weaknesses, is that I want to please people. I want to make people happy. I want there to be, you know, harmony with everyone. And the reality is that that's just not always possible, and that I'm going to feel really strongly about something that other people are not going to. And I think when I look back, I think I, you know, didn't do enough of just saying, hey, this is my opinion. You can like it or you can leave it, you know?
We ask our guests to share a place that matters in the Northwest. What is such a place?
That's very easy for me. And if you follow me on Instagram, you're going to know exactly what I'm saying. But one of the most important places for me in the whole world is Carkeek Park. I don't live that far from it. In the summer, I go every day. In the winter, I'm there, you know, more two or three times a week because, one, it is just incredibly beautiful, incredible trees. It's like a little forest up there. There's a lot of people think of Carkeek Park and think of just like the beach. And of course the beach is beautiful, but I often don't go to the beach because I usually have my dog with me and you don't want to take your dog down to the beach. But there's this incredible hiking trails. I just get up there in the trails and just feel at peace. And I just love getting to see all the growth. I take a lot of pictures of it. So it's just an incredibly beautiful spot. My kids have gone there all the time too. So I just love the space, and it's where I'm at all the time.
And then you brought an object to share with us.
I did. I brought one of our set of earrings from Eighth Generation. And the reason I chose these is that, one, they're one of my favorites. They're really beautiful. It's this very traditional kind of beadwork design on the outside of it. But it's also made with, you know, enamel and metal. And it's a very modern interpretation of a very classic Anishinaabe design. This is also kind of fun for me, too, because we have a similar flower in the Athabascan culture. And I just think that this is a beautiful representation of who we are as Native people. Yes, we are very much rooted in our traditions, rooted in our traditional culture and art and design, but we also have the modern interpretation of it and having it in, it's not beaded, it's made out of metal and enamel, and it's just an incredible evolution. And I think that is what's so wonderful about the Native community. And I love these.
Well, let's just talk about 8th Gen.
Yeah.
So following your mayoral race, you became the CEO of a corporation. So you moved into the business world.
I did.
Why?
And, well, first I got a text from my friend Louis Gong. He said, give me a call. Nothing important. So I didn't call him for a couple of days. And he called me. I was in the car. My kids were in the car, too. Louis said, listen, I want to retire from being the CEO. He was like, I just want to be an artist. I was like, great. I love his art. And he was like, and I think you should consider being the next CEO at 8th Generation. I was just stunned. I said, okay, well, let me think about it. And as soon as I hung up in the car, my kids were like, Mom, you have to do it. You have to be the next CEO at 8th Generation. And that made me really happy for a bunch of reasons. One, I want them to see themselves as CEOs and to see themselves as the future leaders of this country, whether it's in business or wherever. Like, I want them to see that. And then two, what was exciting about it for me is that they wanted me to be at 8th Generation because they thought it was cool. And they saw themselves represented in Native art and design that was literally done nowhere else. Like, 8th Generation has created a whole new pathway for Native artists and designers. And so they saw themselves represented there. And we had been buying 8th Gen products for the past, 6 to 10 years. And so they were just like just incredibly excited. And I really think that I like the idea of our kids kind of, guiding us along the path. And so, I thought about it for 2 or 3 weeks. I met with the tribe. The Snoqualmie tribe owns 8th Generation. I met with my boss, the executive director of government affairs and special projects. Her name is Jamie. One of the smartest people I've ever met. She's so smart. And so it was just so fun to think about getting to work for a brilliant Native woman and for a tribe that's just doing this incredible, creative, innovative work. And so I said yes, and I have loved every minute. I'm so lucky.
I
am so lucky to get to work at 8th Gen and to work for the Snoqualmie tribe.
Well, tell me about Louis, the founder of 8th Gen, and he bootstrapped it.
Oh, gosh, Louis, I mean, blood, sweat, and tears to get this company moving forward. And Louis, he is an incredible artist, number one, and so innovative and an incredible hard worker. And he is also an activist. And so he saw that there was, a lot of Native culture and art has been appropriated for years in this country. And he said, what can we do? And he started drawing on shoes. And then he started thinking, what if we made blankets? And so he started, creating these beautiful wool blankets that are just competition to Pendleton, frankly. And so, Pendleton in Indian country they're very well known. I mean, I know that I personally have been given over 20 Pendletons. Like, we give in Indian country, we give each other blankets as ceremony and as care for each other. But Pendleton's been making a lot of money on Native art and design for a long time. And they also, one thing I like to always mention about this too, is that, and it's not just Pendleton, but it's other brands like them, they have dictated what Native art and design should look like. in quotes, it's this more traditional look, but it really, like the Chief Joseph blanket, as far as I know, which is one of their most famous designs, as far as I know, there no Native person actually designed that. It was just, you know, somebody who Pendleton hired or whatever that just took these different geometrics and put them into this beautiful shape. It's beautiful, but it's not, I don't think it's designed, I don't think it's Native. I don't think it's designed by a Native person. So that is harmful. So when I have, like, you know, this very beautiful traditional Anishinaabe flower design, some people have actively said this to me because I've asked for feedback. They've said, I look at that and I don't see it as Native. And that is a problem. Mm. That is harming the Native community. That is saying that these Native artists and designers, that their art doesn't matter. And so Louis, in this brilliant decision to start this company, to work with Native artists from all over the country, to create this collaboration, to create all of these products. You know, we have over 300 products that we sell. I'm really grateful for all of the work that Louis did to make this company as vibrant and thriving as it is, and that I get to come in and just kind of carry on the vision of this guy who I've just admired for so long. Like, I just think he's the greatest.
And then the tagline, inspired Natives, not Native inspired, which I believe Louis came up with. Can you unpack that for our listeners?
Yeah, so I can remember hearing that tagline for the first time and just being blown away. Like, inspired Natives, so powerful, such a statement. So, like, yes, like, this is an inspired group of people that are special. Because honestly, you know, we are special. I think Native people are the coolest, right? And also, there's just the reality that we didn't vanish, to go back to my original point. Like, we're still here. We were able to survive in our own lands and have these sovereign, I always try to remind people, like, we're talking about sovereign nations. Snoqualmie is a sovereign nation. And so when we think about that inspired Native vision that Louis had, it's just incredibly powerful. And it's even more powerful when you think about Native inspired, right? Because the Native inspired piece came about because folks were, you know, getting, you know, our Native art and design, and we're putting in all kinds of things, creating, you know, there's a lot of people out there to this day who are making, you know, taking, you know, Native art and design and putting in all kinds of products. And Louis was just so smart to come up with that phrase, inspired Natives, not Native inspired, and to really call out the cultural appropriation that has, one, been incorrect. It's put out an incorrect version of what Native art and design is. And two, has harmed the community. It's taken away real dollars from the community. You know, eighth generation, we go out to the Santa Fe Indian Market all the time now. It happens every year in Santa Fe. Thousands of Native artists come together. And the crazy part about the Santa Fe Indian Market is it was founded 101 years ago, not by Native people. It was founded by non-Native people who, again, thought, man, we're going to, these folks are vanishing so quickly, and we're going to lose out on all this beautiful art and design. Let's bring them together so we can buy as much of it as cheaply as we can and hoard it for ourselves. And so what we're seeing now is an absolute renaissance and break, incredible breakthrough of Native art and design. We're seeing it all over the place. We're seeing, you know, incredible artists like Jamie Okuma and Bethany Yellowtail, and we just have all this, like, incredible stuff happening that I feel so fortunate to be the age I am and to experience it. You know, my dad, it wasn't as cool to be Native back then, right? Like, I feel like we're so lucky to be in this phase of life and to see some power and some influence, and so and to show people this is real Native art and design, and that, yes, you can be a part of it. You can buy it. You can wear it. You can put it in your home. But we'd like to kindly ask you not to create Native art unless you are, because we only have so many of us left, and we need to, like, keep it in the family for a while and keep it close to us.
You mentioned the Snoqualmie tribe and their acquisition.
Yeah.
A lot of tribes are acquiring keystone brands. Talk a little bit about tribal governments and their role in entrepreneurship right now, because I think we're in an interesting time.
So the Snoqualmie tribe, you know, of course, has been around since time immemorial, but they've only been federally recognized for the past 20 years. And so they're maybe not as well known as Muckleshoot or, you know, Suquamish as being a tribal government. And so they were, I think, so smart to buy this, you know, young and upcoming company that gets a lot of media. And also, I think, you know, I've heard them say, like, we want to support Native artistry. We want to support the longevity and the prosperity of Native entrepreneurs. And so I am just thrilled that, you know, Suquamish and the other tribes in this area have just been doing this incredible work. The tribes out here in Washington have just been so wonderful to me and my family, and I think to a lot of other Native people who are not necessarily from this area. So I think the world of them.
So your mission is to bring 8th Gen global.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's happening. And I also want to just preface that Seattle is a place historically, whether it's Nordstrom or REI, we have been a producer of products and brands that have gone global.
Yeah.
As well. So you're following in footsteps of others.
We are. And we're also trying to innovate in that space. And I think the past year and a half for me has been building a solid foundation so that we can be ready for the wholesale business we know that's right ahead of us. And so we have this huge warehouse out in Georgetown. We can push out hundreds of orders. We can push out hundreds of, we have a huge inventory now, and we are ready. And our wholesale business has been just really taking off in the past 6 months. We now have two whole people dedicated to actually doing it. And we're getting out there and talking to people. So that's going to be a big part of our business, is getting it out there into the masses in ways that we can't do just through our own stream. But I will say that one of the biggest questions, the number one question that we get at 8th Generation through our social media or through email is, hey, I'm non-Native. Can I buy these products? And I remember really clearly going to Japan in 2018 before the pandemic with my family and looking around, and like everywhere was Japanese art and design. And I like to remind people that even if you're non-Native, you live on Native territory, Native space. And if we had lived in a, you know, a just society, it would be the norm to have Native art and design. And so if you're one of those people that's a conscious buyer, you believe in justice and you believe in beauty. Like, we just have some beautiful stuff out there. Like, our products are quality and beautiful. And so we just want to remind people that you do not have to be Native to enjoy this. It should be the norm to have Native art and design in people's home. I don't want any Native kids to have to experience what my kids have gone through about, the, you know, back to the story about, you know, hey, you know, I thought you all died like the dinosaurs. Like, it should be just a part of the normal society to have Native art and design in people's homes. And that's where we're heading. So we're at the very beginning.
It's so exciting,
of, like,
Colleen,
seeing it all out there.
So how can our listeners support 8th Generation and purchase some of these beautiful products?
Buy at 8th Generation, and we'll have a code set up for you all. The code will be 10%, and it's Power of Place.
Power of Place for 10% off, and even without the 10% off, it's an amazing place. We've been shopping there for years. We absolutely love it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
This has been just incredible.
Thank you. It was so much fun.
Join us next time for a conversation with Sarah Eichorn, whose father, Montana-born and Idaho-bred Dennis Eichorn, helped define Seattle's arts and music scene of the 1980s and 90s. Dennis was editor of the entertainment weekly The Rocket, as well as the author of the comic book series Real Stuff, known for its unvarnished adult content, often involving sex, drugs, and alcohol. Dennis's autobiographical fiction has been compared to the work of Jack Kerouac and Charles Bukowski, who was a friend of Dennis. Beginning with the challenges of her own childhood in Olympia, Washington, on to life in Bellingham and Port Townsend, before settling in Bremerton, Washington, Sarah shares remarkable stories along the path of forging her own identity, tales that include incarceration and recovery from addiction. Her insider's insights into the artists, writers, and musicians that coalesced around her father will make for a riveting and emotionally compelling dialogue that you won't want to miss. Thank you for joining us today. Audio engineering and sound design by Daniel Gunther, with photography by Travis Lawton, administrative support from Mary Mansour, and theme music written by Toma Nakayama and performed by Grand Hallway, with additional music written by Andrew Weathers, Arcs Duo, and Ryan Love. And for this episode, a special thanks goes out to Superman and to Black Belt Eagle Scout. We record on Coast Salish land at the Jack Straw Cultural Center in Seattle's University District. I'm Edward Krigsman, and you've been listening to Power of Place, Stories of the Pacific Northwest. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe or leave us a review. That's the best way for others to find us. And if you know of a place in the Pacific Northwest that matters to you, please tell us about it. We'd love to share your stories.